Hi, Joe Gelonesi with you, and the Philosopher's Zone begins in 20 seconds, just enough time to tell you about The Money, another podcast from RN, the home of specialist audio. The Money takes a smart look at economics and finance, asking some big questions. The latest pod looks at the blockchain revolution, the facts and the myths. Look for The Money wherever you listen to podcasts, or find it on the RN homepage. On the Philosopher's Zone, a very modern problem.
We face a bit of a crisis of sleep. People are very tired. Very many people are very sleep deprived. And we are anxious about sleep. It also seems as though that sleep is a waste of time. And so this mysterious thing that we spend up to, if we're lucky, a third of our lives doing, seems like something that we don't understand very well, which is true in medicine as well as in philosophy.
Now that mountains of meaningless words and oceans...
For an activity that takes up to 30% of our lives, it's a wonder we don't pay more attention to it. Well, we've been doing our part here at RN through a survey of listeners, and the results are in. As you might anticipate, sleep is an issue, getting enough of it and making it good. Cressida Hayes had her eyes open to the problem when she had a child. As anyone who's cared for a restless baby will know, sleep becomes a precious thing. So began an intellectual journey, as much as a very personal one. Cressida Hayes, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone.
It's great to be here.
Now, you've written that sleep is the new sex. What do you mean by that?
I think that there are two reasons that I want to make that claim. The first is that in many ways, sleep seems to have replaced sex in our cultural imagination. So when you think about how saturated with sexuality our cultures have become and with how really sex is boring, I often find that when I teach students 20 years ago, it used to be kind of risque to teach sexuality studies, but now students sort of visibly yawn when you start talking about sexuality. Whereas sleep, I've found, is something that everybody wants to talk about and is of great interest and concern. So people really often take me aside to tell me their sleep problems in ways that are very reminiscent of the way they used to talk to me about sex. And so one of the ways I think that sleep is the new sex is a kind of substitution thesis. But the other is that my work is in gender and sexuality, and I want to argue that there are lots of ways that gender and sexuality interface with sleep that haven't been very well thought by philosophers. So really my project is to try to tease out some of those connections.
So why haven't philosophers been more generally interested in sleep? I mean, we know that philosophers are interested in dreams and the sort of liminal consciousness states and what that might imply about self and whatever, but not sleep generally, and certainly not in the way that you've constructed it as a problem.
Yeah, so as you say, there's a philosophical tradition of thinking about sleep as an interruption of personal identity or as a kind of test case for skeptical thinking. So Descartes most famously uses the problem of his experience of dreaming as his key famous test case for thinking about skepticism and problems of knowledge. But you're right, there's not tremendous examination of sleep apart from what it can show us about something else. And so I think the reason for the renewed interest in the last few years, really across the disciplines, is that we face a bit of a crisis of sleep. People are very tired. Very many people are very sleep deprived. And we are anxious about sleep. It also seems as though, to some of us at least, not to me, that sleep is a waste of time. And so this mysterious thing that we spend up to, if we're lucky, a third of our lives doing seems like something that we don't understand very well, which is true in medicine as well as in philosophy.
You've just said something there that locates it within the bigger economic and political system. Often sleep, in fact, sleep is always talked about as a subject of health and well-being. You most firmly want to locate, there's a few things that you do, but you most firmly want to locate it back in the political economic system that we are in at the moment, and that sleep is required as one long phase through the night so you can be ready and chipper to get on with the next day.
Yeah, I think that we have a very normative view of sleep. And by we, I mean a sort of dominant cultural imaginary in Western cultures that one goes to sleep at a certain time late in the evening and then gets up perhaps 7 or, if you're lucky, 8 hours later, having slept through. It's a view that we, or it's a normative way of sleeping that we try often to impose on children. But it's historically not how everybody has slept. And it's, of course, culturally not how everybody sleeps. So I was recently in rural Spain, and they are clinging to their siesta with great enthusiasm. So the norm of taking a nap in the afternoon still persists there. So there are lots of other ways of sleeping, but we've become, I think, quite preoccupied with the idea that one should be a monophasic nighttime sleeper. And for many people, that's challenging in all sorts of ways.
Monophasic. Now, there's a term, because I didn't know of the term biphasic sleep. And although the siesta makes sense to me, often in the afternoon I do want to drop underneath my desk and have a sleep, the biphasic idea of through the night, as in sleeping in two modes, you know, sleeping and then waking and then going to sleep again, and in that wakeful period doing something, this is a type of sleep that predates electric light, isn't it? In Western cultures, anyway.
Yeah, this is the thesis that historian Roger Ekirch famously articulated in his book At Day's Close, where he talks about the evidence that he accumulates that prior to the invention of electric light, when people lived in darkness, if the sun wasn't up, apart from lamps and candles, that they would go to sleep what we would consider fairly early in the evening, and then sleep until the small hours, and then wake for a period of 1 or 2 hours and do all sorts of household tasks. Or he famously cites an example of somebody who decides to go and steal from their neighbours, and all sorts of not just individual, but also sometimes social activities before going back to bed and sleeping until sunrise. So it makes sense, if you have no source of light, to spend longer in your overall sleep phase and to use that time when you don't actually need to be asleep in the middle of the night for more meditative kinds of activities. And so he makes a very convincing case, I think, for that, and suggests that we can see, as industrialization creeps across the world, really, that sleep patterns have changed quite a bit, because we now have the capacity at the flick of a switch, most of us, to be illuminated in full light, in full incandescent light, all through the night. And of course, as people watch TV, they use their phones and their tablets and so on increasingly in bed, we are actually exposed to more and more light during what are putatively our sleeping hours. And so sleep patterns have changed quite a bit, including not just the electric light, but other kinds of light. So it seems as though our idea that you must just have one big chunk of sleep at night is quite historically contingent.
Mm. So industrialization has something to answer for there.
Well, I mean, it depends. Some people, you might say, what is one better than the other? I mean, that's a hard thing to adjudicate. Ekirch is quite convincing about the merits of that period of wakefulness between the two periods of sleep, right? He's quite compelling when he describes how it could be really valuable time. It makes you more likely to remember your dreams because of the way the sleep phases work. And so dreams seem to have been more important to our historical ancestors, and that's perhaps because they had sleep practices that made them more likely to recall them.
Hmm. I guess in my question there is a negative assessment there, simply from the point of view that I'm wondering whether it's more, and I'll be careful to use this word in a philosophical program, whether it's more natural to have biphasic sleep.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
Hmm. There is also a thing called polyphasic sleep. And I know that you've also identified the sort of the Uberman and Uberwoman of the modern world trying to knock sleep right down to small segments so you can get much more in your life.
It does. I'm laughing because I sort of personally can't imagine anything worse. But yes, there are plenty of websites and blogs and chat groups and so on that are organized around changing your sleep patterns so that you can maximize your awake time. And the Uberman multiphasic sleep pattern, or polyphasic, is basically that you get, I mean, there's lots of ways of doing it, but you work up to, you have more and more short sleep periods during a 24-hour cycle until you train yourself to sleep for, let's say, 6 20-minute basically naps during the 24-hour cycle. So your overall sleep is much less than it would be if you were a monophasic or even a biphasic sleeper. And you get all this wonderful time to plan world domination. Of course, the Ubermann, I don't know if the people who invented that name know this, but is so evocative of Nietzsche, right? And so it just sounds like this kind of crazy philosopher who's somehow going down the drain, but is gonna nonetheless plan his way of taking everything with him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you cite aspects of private life, such as having a baby, as being core to a discussion about sleep. I think it's actually spurred it in you as well to make some sense of that. But what you've done through looking at that is looked at how, in fact, it plays out into a civic and public space and what it says about larger anxieties about the relationship between the citizen and the state. How so?
Yeah, that's the project I'm working on right now, actually. And I just gave a lecture on that material that provoked a really interesting discussion, mostly among people in the audience who'd had babies, I have to say. There's a lot of kind of fellow feeling there. So I have one child, and when he was born, I had this dramatic experience of going from having been a young adult who'd been very fortunate to have a job that meant I could get plentiful and regular sleep to being incredibly sleep deprived. And I really realized why sleep deprivation is a form of torture, right, and widely used as such, because it is very destructive. I mean, it's cognitively destructive, physically destructive. It makes you emotionally labile. You lose your judgment. It's kind of a terrible state to be in. And partly because I'm an academic, but not only, I started reading books about how to get your baby to sleep and very quickly realized that there are tens of them. I mean, it's a huge literature. And they all have the same sort of platitudes at the beginning, that you should do what works for your family and that there's no right answer here and it's going to be okay. But they quickly change, they diverge and offer all sorts of advice about whether you should practice graduated extinction, that is letting your baby cry for longer and longer periods of time until they learn to self-soothe to sleep, whether you should sleep with your baby or your baby must be in a separate room from you, and whether you should maybe be attached to them at all times is the opposite end of the spectrum. And so I realized very fast that there was something going on here that I think can't really be adequately explained by the evidence base, because all the people mostly writing these books are experts in one kind or another of pediatric healthcare, and they all think that the evidence base supports their conclusions. So when you read whatever evidence there is on this, you also can't really see what the right answer is. And so I started to think there were subtexts in these books. And so the position I started to develop is that if you look historically at the 20th century and the way that advice to parents about children's sleep really proliferates very rapidly in the mid to late 1970s, what you see is a reflection of a larger political and economic anxiety about the relationship of the citizen to the state, as you say. So if you think about neoliberal economics and in the 1980s, the increasing desire to make citizens independent of the welfare state, to roll back the welfare state and create people who were highly autonomous and capable of caring for themselves without any need of attachment or dependence, then I think it's a small step to a kind of feminist object relations argument about how these books are parables, really, of those sorts of anxieties. And they're parables of the neoliberal position and of reactions to it when we see anxiety about this excessive autonomy and the way that it actually creates social problems, right? So if you think about the social capital literature or the way that crime rates change, you can see that, in fact, perhaps leaving people to fend for themselves might have negative social consequences. So you want to reattach them to something, but it might not be the welfare state. It might be that the family becomes a new site for managing the deviant or disruptive citizen, or potentially so. And so I think that you see in a lot of the returns to maternalism and the demands of mothers, that mothers manage their children's sleep, again, a kind of political anxiety about wanting to create good kinds of citizens in a post-welfare age.
On the Philosopher's Zone, Cressida Hayes on sleep and what it might say about bigger things. including gender relations between wakeful men and sleeping women.
The other work I've done is thinking about the literary and aesthetic representation of women who are unconscious, so sometimes asleep, sometimes putatively dead, right? Just trying to think about that, which is a very long aesthetic tradition that a lot of people don't really think about. But if you recall Sleeping Beauty and Snow White, they're fairy tales that we're all familiar with. And I think that they have a terrific cultural significance. And so I've been looking at the representation, basically, of sleeping people, some women, some men, and thinking about what kind of messages they send. And I finished a paper that is looking at the way, in contemporary cases of sexual violence, that sexual assault against unconscious women is understood, and what's distinctively bad about it, because I think that there is a kind of nasty cultural moment when it's represented as less serious if you're raped while you're unconscious than if something happens to you while you are awake. And so that's one problem that I've been thinking through in the context of gender and sexuality. So one part of the book is about representation and the aesthetic and how that leads us into some of these other political questions.
I know you write about Briar Rose, or is it Princess Aurora, which I find a fascinating example. Can you tell me a little bit about how that fairy tale, that folk tale works?
Yeah, it's such an interesting example, and I think that most people don't know the full history of the story. So if you go back and you read, it's a medieval tale originally, if you go back and you read the very earliest in English examples of that story, then what you find is a similar beginning to the story. So an evil fairy comes to the christening of Princess Aurora. She's been excluded. And when Aurora is cursed by the fairy to die, in fact, another fairy, a good one, steps in and says, no, she'll just prick her finger on a spindle and lapse into 100 years of sleep, which comes to pass. And what's interesting about that sleep is that in the Disneyfied version, she's woken by a kiss from her prince, who has to, you know, fight his way through this forest of thorns in a way that's highly reminiscent, I suggest in the essay that I wrote about this, of a vagina dentata, a toothed vagina, right, which is a very classic medieval image. And once he gets there, again, for Disney, he kisses her, but in these medieval versions, he rapes her and then leaves, and she doesn't wake up. And it just continues to unfold in this macabre way that she's pregnant, she's still asleep. She gives birth to twins, she's still asleep. And the twins start to breastfeed, and she's still asleep. And the only reason that she wakes up is because one of these twins mistakes her thumb, where she's pricked her finger, for a nipple and sucks out the poison thorn, at which point she wakes up to discover that having gone to sleep, a teenager, a virgin teenager, she has now woken up and is a mother, at which point the prince returns and they fall in love and get married. So there are lots of feminist interpretations of that story. And one of the interesting, I think, interpretations is that she manages to bypass a lot of the messy work of adolescence and growing up as a woman, that she falls asleep and when she wakes up, it's all done, it's signed and sealed. And in these stories, of course, becoming a wife and mother is the end of a woman's life, right? After that, she doesn't really have a history. That's the happy ending. And so she doesn't have to fight through the difficulty of adolescence. And some people even say that the welling drop of blood on her finger when she's pricked by the spindle symbolizes first menstruation, right? That this is the point at which she becomes an adolescent woman, and then she just immediately conks out and misses all of that messy stuff. And when I've given that talk and I've suggested that as a kind of interpretation of the story, I've had women who have adolescent daughters come up to me afterwards and say, well, you know, obviously I don't want my daughter to be raped by some prince, but I do kind of wish she would go to sleep and wake up when it's all over.
Oh, interesting end to that tale, but I get the gender relations and I get what the issue there is with the construction of male and female, feminine and masculine in those stories. But what is the role of sleep then? What do we make of sleep in all of that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that in these stories, sleep is almost always signaling something about time. And it signals a suspension of time. And you see, for women, I think, agency has historically been less valued. So living your own life, doing your own thing, is something that the likes of Oprah have made part of our cultural vocabulary. But in a lot of European traditions, especially for white bourgeois women, passivity and letting life happen to you is something that is highly valued as an attribute of desirable femininity. And so time is suspended for these women, while time is advanced by men. So it's the action of men that moves things forward, right? So women don't live in time because they're asleep, while men are the agents who ensure that time moves forward. So it's a kind of overinflation of masculine agency and minimizing any possibility of feminine agency. So I think that that's the connection that I want to develop, is the way that sleep and gender and time come together.
From a phenomenological point of view, then, the phenomenology of that state for the feminine or the female ceases, but in fact it's actually the male's arc, I guess, is the mm-hmm. important one. Is that what you're getting at?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that his lived experience is the lived experience that exists in time, right? And hers just doesn't, which is, of course, an interesting recapitulation of what lots of canonical philosophers have said about sleep, right? Is it in time? Is it outside of time? How do we think about my lived experience in relation to time? But it has this interesting kind of gender twist. And in lots of contemporary film or visual art or performance art, you see feminist artists and interpreters playing with that idea in interesting ways, right? So the Australian film, Julia Lee's 2011 film, Sleeping Beauty, plays with this idea. Or Tilda Swinton did a Museum of Modern Art installation where she slept in a glass box while people watched her. And so in those kinds of artistic representations, there's a kind of pushing against the idea that the Sleeping Beauty just lies there and the story continues around her as men enact it.
Mm. But you've actually cited Salvador Dali's 1937 work, Sleep, as being quite emblematic yeah. of the way the concept of sleep, as you've been looking at it. Can you tell me a little bit about Dali's Sleep and why that talks to you?
There are his Melting Clock series, which I think are a kind of experimentation with time and with the way that time can so easily change for us, right? So the indexing of time to individual experience. And then the one that I think you're referring to that's called Sleep is, it's a very strange and hard to describe image, but anyone can Google it, of a sort of giant amorphous head that is propped up on sticks. And it just captures, I think, the way that sleep is about a person, it's about an individual being in a different state, but it's also about the loss of individual distinctiveness that occurs in that state. And it's about there's something nightmarish about it, right? There's something that seems to capture that kind of weird, blobby, things don't look like they're supposed to look, that is so often the experience of dreaming. And so I think surrealism is a really great genre for capturing some of the meanings of sleep.
Cressida Hayes, I should let you go home and have your dinner, but do you have any good tips, any tips for a good night's sleep?
People always ask me that. I wrote quite a well-known article about weight loss, and people always come up to me at the end of talks and say, how do you lose weight? I feel like now it's switched to, how do you get good sleep? So I think I just have totally common sense advice, which is always to go to bed at the same time if you can, and to avoid screens around the time that you go to bed as much as you can. And, you know, to make your sleeping space cool and dark and all of that stuff. I don't really do any of those things myself, but I think most of us are just so tired that we kind of just lapse into unconsciousness when our head hits the pillow. Or if we don't, then it might be something a little bit more serious than a philosopher can help you with.
I look forward to reading more of your work. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks very much.
Yes, there are some areas beyond reach.
Cressida Hayes is Professor of Philosophy and Political Science at the University of Alberta. For the record, our sleep snapshot revealed that 76% of respondents are indeed worried about sleep. Deep dive into the data via the RN homepage. Time for our nap. Thanks to Diane Dean and Lila Shunar. I'm Joe Gelonesi. See you next time in the Philosopher's Zone.